Let's do two quick door prizes. Make it quick. And we will do three at lunchtime. Eugene, are you there? Go.
What I will say this first is
what we did last year.
For the Georgia Council of the Blind.
Can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
No. Could we have the microphone, please, for Kentucky Council of the Blind in the center aisle front?
Hello?
Okay, we'll do more door prizes later. Okay, anybody who wants a free ticket for the Louisville Sluggers, call room 452. And now for an exciting announcement, President Paul Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, just before she left, Janice Wharton, who is one of the attorneys from the Department of Justice, came up to the podium to announce some very exciting news, I think. And that is that the Department of Justice has decided to file an amicus curiae in a case in the Fifth Circuit involving Internet access. I'm extremely excited that the Department of Justice has recognized this is an important issue, and it is my hope that what we'll be able to do is see this case through to its final solution and once and for all put to bed the notion that you don't have to have accessible websites. There are two general announcements. One is that the Louisiana Council of the Blind will caucus at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday in room 483 in the East Tower. And the second one is a reminder of those people who are going on the Belle of Louisville cruise tonight. Those of you who are going, please be in the lobby of the East Tower by 7 p.m. Please remember that the boat's leaving. If you're not there, it will leave without you. Ms. Beatty.
Mr. President.
Madam Chairman, if you'd like to do the door prizes, the mics are on.
Okay, go ahead. All right, go ahead. Do one door prize, Eugene. One door prize. Are you ready? Okay, never mind. All right, the Iowa Council of the Blind will caucus at 5:30 on Thursday in room 580.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
Lucille Fierce, Missouri.
Who calls for the floor?
Lucille Fierce, Missouri.
For what purpose?
Information?
Yes.
I must show my stupidity.
Please, can you speak a little louder into the microphone or closer?
Okay. I'm going to show my stupidity. I don't have a computer. Will Paul please tell me what this issue is that the Justice Department just notified him of?
We're going to get more information, and then when we have details, we'll explain the whole thing to everybody.
Okay. As long as
all right.
When I go back, I want to know what I'm talking
hopefully
about.
We'll be able to, we'll all know the details by then.
Okay.
All right, I want to move on. We are behind schedule from what it says in the program, but that'll mean a little less business at the end. There's one more announcement, and that is that Chairman Michael Byington wants to remind you all that the deadline for resolutions is 10 p.m. tonight in room 1700 West.
Madam Chairman.
Who calls for the floor?
Adrian DeBlay from Wisconsin. Very briefly, it's been brought to my attention by several observant people that the East Tower was neglected from our caucus announcement in the newspaper. We are at 459 East at 4 p.m. this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. Okay, it is my pleasure now to move on with the program. And unfortunately, Julie Carroll has had to return to Virginia. However, substituting for her as representing ACB's Environmental Access Committee is Debbie Grubb. So Debbie will introduce her panel. Please welcome Debbie Grubb, pinch hitting.
Nothing, testing.
Mic number two, I think, guys.
Mic three.
Good morning, everybody. It's my great pleasure to add my voice to those who have sent greetings to you and to folks out in ACB Radio Land. It was one of the great thrills of my life a little while ago to be able to turn on ACB Radio. I thought I'd really accomplished something, so this is really pretty phenomenal. It is my great happiness to be able to stand in for Julie Carroll today. She is a fine chair of our ACB Environmental Access Committee. I have learned much from her, and I'm very sorry she can't be here, but she has assembled a fine panel, and I think we're going to learn some things about our pedestrian environment today that will help us go back to our communities and better advocate for safe, accessible intersections where we live and work every day. Remember that all the other things that we fight for, if we can't move around our communities and get to where we need to go, there isn't much point in anything else, is there? So I truly believe in pedestrian access for us, and I am so thrilled that ACB, our officers, our leadership, and our executive director have bought into this so completely. Before we begin our panel discussion today, or our panel presentations, I want to tell all of you who do not know that the second edition of our pedestrian safety handbook that I had the great pleasure to edit is finished, and it is on our ACB website. Charlie Crawford, through much diligence and hard work and good selling qualities that he has found ways to finance the production of our pedestrian safety handbook in all of the formats that we need. Until that is accomplished, however, you can find it on the ACB website, and you can get it and print it out and share it with everyone and spread that gospel. The pedestrian safety handbook is much broader this time than our first issue. It not only covers accessible pedestrian signals, but it covers the identification of actual intersections through the use of tactile warnings. The handbook is full of information that will help you educate traffic engineers and other politicians and bureaucrats about why the problem exists and the nature of the problem. There's tons of information in the book about how signage works, where you can purchase it. There's anecdotal information about the problems. There's all kinds of information in terms of data. And it is my hope that this pedestrian safety handbook will be a toolbox that you can proudly use as you advocate where you are for pedestrian safety everywhere. What we're going to do is, first of all, we're going to present to you two members of the faculty of Western Michigan University who work in the Department of Blind Rehabilitation. Their names are Richard Long, who will be speaking to you first, and then he will be introducing his colleague, David Guth. While Richard is speaking to you, David will be coming in the audience and passing out for you to look at and pass along down the road some diagrams of roundabouts, because that is what these gentlemen are going to speak to you about. Those of us who live in Maryland, for example, are all too familiar with the roundabout syndrome and claiming the intersection and how impossible that is and how inaccessible roundabouts are for blind people. So I, like you, am most interested in hearing their report. At the conclusion of their report, we will introduce our final two panelists. And so without any further ado, we will now have our first presentation from Richard Long.
Thank you very much, Deborah, for that introduction. We are very glad to be here with you today and glad to have an opportunity to talk briefly about our work with roundabouts. What we're going to do today is describe briefly the characteristics of roundabouts, talk about why we think you should be aware of them and knowledgeable about roundabouts, Dave Guth, in a little while we'll talk about our research effort in the last year and a half in this area. And finally, and perhaps most important, we want to talk about what you can do at your local level when you're approached by traffic engineers and others concerning the installation of roundabout intersections. Before I begin, however, let me just say a couple of words of acknowledgement. Certainly, we are very thankful to ACB for the seed money and the support that you all have provided during the last year and a half to help us get this work started. Charlie Crawford has been very supportive, as has Julie Carroll. We're grateful for that, certainly. The U.S. Access Board also, led by Lois Tebow, Lorinda Steele is here, I believe, and others at the U.S. Access Board have been very supportive and helpful as well, both financially and morally. Finally, Dr. Paul Poncilla is an important member of our team. Dr. Poncilla, some of you know, he's a member of our faculty at Western Michigan University, and we're very pleased that he's supporting us in this effort. Lucas Frank, who will speak in a moment as well. So there are many people who have contributed to our success in this area. One of the ways that we're, I think, making a mark here is that we were notified that as of last Saturday, we have received a $4 million five-year grant from the National, thank you. The National Eye Institute has awarded us a $4 million five-year grant to study in great detail blind pedestrians' access at complex intersections. We are thrilled about that because for the first time, first of all, for the first time, NIH is directly involved in mobility research. And secondly, for the first time, we have the resources now to really investigate this area thoroughly. And we will be doing a broad program of research that will include roundabouts and other types of what we are calling complex intersections. And we look forward to continuing our partnership with ACB and pairing with you as we do that work. Now let me move on to talking about roundabouts briefly. First of all, why are roundabouts important? I think they're important to you because, simply put, they're going to grow dramatically in number in the next 10 years or so. They're coming. The roundabout revolution, as the traffic engineers call it, is coming. They're relatively few now. They're probably between 100 and 200 in the United States, mostly in the Baltimore area. Florida has a number of them. There's a number of roundabouts in the Avon Vale area of Colorado. Those of you from those states probably recognize those roundabouts. But they're relatively few in number. But they will definitely grow. Roundabouts have positive aspects. They have negative aspects. And we hope today to educate you a little bit about both of those kinds of aspects. Now to move on to what is a roundabout. Dave Guth, my colleague, has handed out into the audience a raised diagram that we brought. Unfortunately, we only brought about 60 of them. My apologies that each of you don't have one. What we're trying to do is just sort of pass one down each row, and it will provide you sort of an overhead view of the way a roundabout typically is laid out. But here's how the story goes. A roundabout typically is a circular intersection. In the center is a central island that's raised. Vehicles don't drive across the central island. Pedestrians don't walk across the central island. That central island is simply to deflect traffic as it comes into the roundabout, so the traffic must drive slowly. So it begins with a central island. Surrounding that central island is the circulating roadway where the vehicles circulate. And then typically at a roundabout, there are three or four or five streets that come in from various directions. So traffic enters the roundabout, circles around until it gets to its exit, and then it exits the roundabout. Very important feature, there are no signals at a roundabout. There are no stop signs at a roundabout. The only traffic control at a roundabout is a yield sign. Vehicles who enter the roundabout must yield to vehicles that are already in the circulating roadway. One way to think about it is just think about a donut. The vehicles drive on the cake, and the center hole would represent that center the center island. Usually for pedestrian, there are crosswalks located just outside the roundabout itself. In other words, the crosswalks are on the entry and exit legs of the roundabout. And typically those are painted crosswalks on the pavement. Roundabouts can have single lanes coming in. Oftentimes, though, you'll have a one-lane road. Right as it gets to the roundabout, it'll split into two lanes or three lanes. That way, more cars can enter more quickly. They move more vehicles that way. It does pose challenges for pedestrians, however, because sometimes you can cross one lane, but then the vehicle in the next lane fails to yield for you. So that can present some difficulties for pedestrians. Roundabouts are used in a variety of environments. They're used in urban settings, in residential settings, and more in commercial or business settings. We will see them grow, as I said, dramatically in number in all of those settings. Roundabouts have very positive features. Largely, those positive features accrue to drivers and people who ride in vehicles. And that's what traffic engineers tend to focus on. For example, roundabouts significantly reduce the death and severe injury rate when accidents do occur. You have vehicles that are moving rather slowly. You have vehicles that, because of the way things are designed, they cannot turn left in front of ongoing traffic and get broadsided. That's not possible with a roundabout. For those reasons and others, roundabouts yield considerable safety benefits to drivers. They're a good thing. I think our challenge here is to figure out how everybody can have access to this type of intersection. We're not anti-roundabout. We're supportive of roundabouts, but we do want to ensure that all people, regardless of disability or any other aspect, can access roundabouts adequately. Roundabouts are imported to us from Europe. There are about 40,000 of them in Europe. 40,000. Remember I said there were 1 to 200 here in the United States. So this roundabout explosion started in the United States, in Europe, and it is moving across to us. There are 20,000 in France alone. One of the things we've often heard is that, well, they're no problem in Europe. They're no problem in Europe. The traffic engineers tell us things are working out okay in Europe. Blind people just listen for a gap in traffic. Other people listen for a gap in traffic, and they go. No problem. We decided it was important to check that out because we heard that story a lot from transportation engineers here in the U.S. So in March, with the support of Western Michigan University, we traveled to Europe and we went to London. We went to Lyon, France. We met with traffic engineers. We met with orientation mobility instructors there in Europe. And we also met with blind and visually impaired individuals. And here's what we learned in a nutshell. We learned that the answers do not lie in Europe, that roundabouts are quite difficult many times for people with visual impairment and blindness in Europe. Oftentimes, individuals avoid them there. There's some other solutions. One lady we met with in Lyon, France, in very eloquent French, told us that her strategy at a roundabout was to pray and go. We enjoyed that strategy. Sometimes in London we found the British are rather civil to one another, and they tend to put mid-block pedestrian signals near roundabouts that are pedestrian-actuated and accessible. And in that way, they try to resolve some of the issues that roundabouts raise. But it's not a completely satisfactory situation. And as I say, we did find a number of people simply avoided them. So the long and short of it is the magic bullet was not found in Europe. This is a complex problem. It's an important kind of intersection design. It has great benefit, and we are looking forward in the next few years to really digging into these complex issues with your support, understanding the issues, and then coming up with good, sound, usable solutions to the problems. Dave's now going to take a few minutes and tell you what we've done in the past year more specifically and what you can do in your own community.
Thanks very much, Richard. I'd like to point out that, as all of you know, at any intersection, if you're going to cross the street, there are a number of tasks that have to be performed, and a number of those will be discussed by other speakers up here today. They include, for example, locating the crosswalk, getting lined up in the correct direction to cross the street, either aligned with the crosswalk or the opposite side of the street. Knowing when it's safe to step out into the street and travel across the street. In the case of a roundabout, since roundabouts are characterized by splitter islands in the center, those triangles on the diagrams, it's important to know that you've arrived there. Anytime you cross any street, there are a bunch of pieces to the subtasks to the overall task of getting across the street. And based on our discussions with both transportation engineers and individuals who are blind and visually impaired, including members of our faculty, we decided to focus our initial efforts on assessing individuals' assessments of when it's in fact safe to begin across the street at a roundabout. I have about 4 hours worth of details of this study and 7 minutes in which to present it, so I'm going to quickly try to give it to you in a nutshell. We have focused our efforts in the greater Baltimore area. Maryland, Colorado, and Florida in the U.S. are the states that seem to be most aggressively installing roundabouts. And people in Maryland have certainly taken a lot of heat for one of the roundabouts I'll talk about, in particular the Towson roundabout in downtown Towson, Maryland, but have been very receptive. They see it as a problem. They're not quite sure what to do about it and have been very supportive of this work. So we have examined very high-volume roundabouts, two-lane roundabouts, relatively low-volume roundabouts. There was someone here from Seattle, and in Seattle they tend to put mini roundabouts in residential areas, small one-lane roundabouts. We've also looked at roundabouts somewhere in the middle that are quite similar to the roundabout on the design that is being passed around the room today. The people who participated in this research to this point have included mostly people who were totally blind. We've worked with one individual with low vision and plan to continue to do a lot of work in that area. We've also worked with individuals with typical sight. We have developed a procedure for measuring judgments about whether someone believes it's safe or not to start out across the street at a particular moment. I'm going to skip all the details of that procedure, and at this point I'd ask you to take it on faith that we've sort of figured out what we're doing and be happy to talk to you, any of you, either today or via email about some of these procedures. I would like to skip to some of our findings and tell you sort of in general what our findings have been and then in particular what we think that they may mean. What we found is that when you have very high volume roundabouts, when you're using hearing to make decisions about the time to cross the street, there is a potential problem. And that potential problem, as the vast majority of you are well aware, is masking noise. At a roundabout, and remember these things typically in the U.S. anyway do not have signals, so you may have a continuous flow of traffic on all the legs or all the streets that have both entering traffic and exiting traffic, as well as traffic out there in a circle moving around. So you have a lot of noise in addition to the noise created by the vehicles that may be bearing down on you in the crosswalk that you're about to cross. Consequently, at higher volume roundabouts, pedestrians with visual impairments may experience some very long delays and maybe at some risk in making good judgments about whether or not it's safe to initiate a crossing. And our data seem to be bearing this out. As one highly placed ACB official told us as we were beginning to plan for this work, he said, you know, this is sort of like science showing that water is wet. You know what? I know that. I know that they're potentially a problem. Well, it was important, we believed, to show that water is wet because, as many of you may be out there thinking and believing, yeah, there is a potential problem when you're using hearing to make these decisions, but many of the transportation advocates who are very much in favor of the wholesale installation of roundabouts really believe that water is dry, namely that roundabouts are very safe for everyone, not only drivers but pedestrians, including pedestrians with disabilities. And so we felt it was important to look at the whole range of roundabouts, including those with high levels of traffic and those with relatively low levels of traffic. Now let me skip to a much smaller roundabout, a one-lane roundabout, and this one happened to be on a ring road that goes around the University of Maryland Baltimore campus. And at this roundabout, there's not a lot of traffic. When classes change, there may be a rush of a few cars here and there, and when all the professors are leaving early at 3 o'clock to get home, you know, the life of the professors, you know, come in at 10 and leave at 3. When they're leaving, you know, there's a little more traffic. But by and large, there are lots of very long gaps in traffic, and so a delay of 3 or 4 seconds waiting for a car to get out of the way so that you can hear what's going on is not that big a deal. So that particular roundabout was not that much of a problem, but there were a couple of interesting issues that were raised even at what was seemingly a very simple roundabout in terms of navigating it. And mind you, I'm talking about a single lane roundabout with a low volume of traffic. In our trip to Europe and in England, we saw many one-lane roundabouts with an almost continuous flow of traffic, and this was not one of those. But a couple of the issues I want to mention, that because they were, I think they would be interesting to you, and many of you will have some insight and experience with this. We happened to be, and actually some of the folks who participated are sitting in the audience today and went through this with us, both at the Towson roundabout, the high-volume roundabout, and this smaller UMBC or University of Maryland roundabout on days when it was cold and rainy, and on days when it was cold and the pavement was dry. And it was interesting because at the smaller roundabout, rain really helps a lot because rain increases the volume of the traffic because of the way the tires pick up the rain that's on the surface of the road and slaps it back down. You get a lot of tire noise, so you can hear you can hear traffic far, far away. And so judgments were actually much easier to make with the addition of a little rain. On the other hand, when you go to a high-volume roundabout where you have traffic entering and exiting from 4 or 5 or 6 different legs of the roundabout as well as 2 lanes of circulating traffic, the resulting cacophony of noise, mostly rain interacting with the tire noise, can create some real problems. So that was something that this experience at the smaller roundabout taught us. The other one was about geography. The smaller roundabout was on a slight hill. Where we gathered our data, vehicles had to come up the hill to enter the roundabout. And so the drivers were stepping on the gas to come up the hill. It was relatively easy for participants in this research to hear someone stepping on the gas because they had to get up the hill. There was a fair amount of engine noise. On the opposite side of the roundabout, there was a very nice golf course and a lot of BMWs and Mercedes rolling down the hill to enter the roundabout almost silently. So conditions at one entry lane, even at the same roundabout, were very different from conditions at the other. So geography certainly plays some sort of role in this. We have now begun to focus our efforts on middle volume roundabouts like those or like the roundabout that's shown in the diagrams that are floating around in the room. And we're interested in following up, looking at a number of really complicated issues because there are a lot of variables involved, including the volume of traffic, the noise made by the traffic, loud car versus quiet car, the number of lanes, the direction that you're making your crossings, that is clockwise versus counterclockwise, which is very relevant given that drivers tend to be looking in a particular direction, which may not be the direction that you're standing and waiting before they enter the roundabout. We think that once these problems are better understood, and as we conduct further research and better understand them, they're going to have to be solved. And it absolutely has to be a combined effort of consumer organizations, individual consumers, representatives of national organizations, transportation engineers, and we think and hope researchers. Hope you keep us in the loop a little bit and allow us to try to help contribute a bit. So the question will be, for roundabouts that are unacceptably risky and or time-consuming, because some of these really are not as risky as much as they create long, long delays, waiting 15 minutes or so before you have a long enough gap to cross, how can they be made more accessible? Are traffic signals the answer, as we've seen many examples of in England? What about better methods of slowing cars down or causing ways to make vehicles themselves make more noise as they approach the roundabout? What about better orientation and mobility training? What about techniques other than pray and go for navigating the intersection? I want to just quickly conclude. Richard mentioned that we would be telling you what you can do at the local level, and I'm not going to tell you what you can do at the local level. I'm going to tell you about a friend of mine and what she was able to do at our local level. And this goes back to what really got us interested in this problem in the first place. I live in a resort community with a burgeoning tourist population and a very growing traffic problem, and it just gets worse every year. No one wants to build wider roads. Roundabout advocates in the United States, at least those that we know, are very charismatic, very articulate, very skillful at being very good proponents of installing roundabouts. Well, they came to our town and over a period of months convinced our community leaders that roundabouts were a big part of the solution to our traffic woes. And as a result, before you knew it, roundabouts were being designed, adopted. The public comment period came along, and my friend with whom we've been friends for 20-some years, a totally blind woman, and we've just been chit-chatting about roundabouts, you know, over the last 2 years and some of the issues. So she doesn't know a lot about them in terms of all the technical jargon of traffic engineers. And she simply took her 5 minutes at the city commission meeting and said, okay, I can see your point that these are good things in terms of saving drivers' lives and see some of the advantages, but what about me? What about pedestrians with visual impairments? And before she asked that question, no one on the city commission had even thought about the issue. Now, this library happened to be intersection where one of the large two-lane, high-capacity roundabouts was going to be installed was across from our regional library for blind and physically handicapped people. And no one had considered this as an issue. In a major downtown urban area, a lot of pedestrian traffic, no one had thought about, well, how are people actually going to get across the street to the library? So by virtue of just asking a few questions, getting people on the city commission to think about the issue, and those people then going to the advocates and saying, hey, you guys, how come you never asked, or how come you never mentioned this is a potential problem? How is this Jane Doe supposed to get across the street? And the transportation engineers don't really have good answers to that. As Richard said, and I'll conclude with, we are not anti-roundabout, but we certainly need to bring traffic and transportation engineers into the picture, make them aware that this is an issue that they need to be addressing as well as we need to be addressing, and trying to figure out what the ultimate accessibility solutions are. Because just as the earlier session was focused on access to information generally, access to information about the pedestrian environment is incredibly important, and we have yet to answer the problems about roundabouts. We hope to make continued progress, but we think the more people ask more questions, the sooner everyone will realize that it's an important problem that they should be devoting some effort to addressing. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Richard and David. Excellent job. I just want to say two quick things before we bring on our next panelist. When I was involved in some of the research on the Towson roundabout, we went over to D.C. and we went across every roundabout, around and around and around, and there's a huge one there called DuPont Circle. What sets it apart is that it is signalized. And we stood there with our guide dogs, most of us had them, and it was night and it was raining, but we could tell every single time when it was time to cross. We went to Annapolis, which has a smaller roundabout similar to the Towson roundabout, which is not signalized, and some of the traffic engineers said to the O&M instructors, why aren't these people claiming the intersection? And they go, I don't want to risk my life by deciding that a driver is going to be nice to me by just stepping out in the intersection and hoping it's going to stop. So all that to say, there is a lot of education that needs to be done. Signalizing has to be done. It is the secret of any safety that is available in Europe, although we've learned that that is kind of dubious. That said, We're going to move on to a great victory that we are celebrating in the realm of pedestrian safety. In 1999, I was in Washington, D.C., along with B.Z. Benson and Janet Barlow and Lucas and Julie and a whole bunch of us, when we had a great victory in terms of language for the Bible of Traffic Engineers, which is called the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices. If it ain't in the MUTCD, they don't want to hear it. So to talk to us for the next 5 minutes or so about the significance of this language and how you can use this victory where you are is Lucas Frank from the Seeing Eye. Get back there, Charlie. Lucas is going first. And what we're leave it to Charlie. You're not next. What we're going to do is, that's right, is have Lucas, who our school funded half of the cost for the production of the handbook. So Lucas is going to talk to us about the significance of the proposed language in MUTCD, and then Charlie, the bad boy, is going to back clean up and talk to us for a couple of minutes, and then we'll be finished.
Thank you, Debbie. For those of you, if you may have heard as I moved to the podium, as Charlie left the podium, you may have heard my chain dragging. That chain is actually a very long leash that the Seeing Eye has given me to participate in this process, and I'd like to thank Ken Rosenthal and Doug Roberts, my supervisors, and the president of the Seeing Eye for their help in allowing that to happen. I'm going to do a little bit of a review of some things that we talked about last year on the presumption that some of the people here weren't there. The MUTCD, the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, governs traffic control devices. That includes stop signs, traffic lights, a variety of other things. But one of the things that has never been mentioned in this federal guidebook is what we used to call audible traffic signals, what we are now referring to as accessible pedestrian signals. The reason we're changed for the name change is that some of the more modern signals that we're advocating, include a vibrating plate of some type that makes them accessible also to people with hearing impairments or both who are both blind and deaf. So there has never been a mention of these in the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices. That meant that from the point of view of traffic engineers, they just plain didn't exist. There's incredible variability around the country. But just to cite you one example, several years ago in State College, Pennsylvania, I was working with a woman who had a hearing loss, had a difficult push-button actuated intersection to cross, and she basically was doing using the French method to get across the street, which was pray and go. She could not independently judge that crossing. An accessible signal would have made it very easy for her. It was a fairly simple and straightforward situation. We went to the town traffic engineer, were denied because it didn't exist in the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices. They had no guidelines on what to put in. Now, this is not a hard and fast rule. Many states, many municipalities, many counties ignore that. But there is no rhyme nor reason in any way that I can see for that the individual traffic engineer decides to or not to put in an accessible pedestrian signal at some of these situations. But they had the excuse that it was not in the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices. Consequently, they had a perfect legitimate excuse, from their point of view, to not put in a device. Several years ago, at the time, Julie Carroll, myself, Donna Sauerberger, B.Z. Benson, Janet Barlow, we began to work with the National Committee on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. The MUTCD is always under revision. When it's every 5 years, they come out with a new one, and then they immediately begin to revise and improve. And it's in a five-year cycle, and we began about 5 years ago to work on changing that, to get something into the Manual and Uniform Traffic Control Devices that would change that situation and remove that excuse. And last year I reported that we had succeeded in drafting some language and that it had gone from the National Committee into the belly of the beast, which is the Department of Transportation, where it was digested. And it emerged again pretty much intact. What we had recommended came out very much as we had sent it in. Some minor changes, some improvements. It then was put into the Federal Register for comment. The comment period ended June 30th, and we now wait to see what will emerge once again from the belly of the beast. We have every hope that there is going to be, for the first time in the year 2000 edition of the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, mention of accessible pedestrian signals, and that that excuse will be gone. What that language actually states, I confess to you now, is less than ideal. It's less than ideal because we frankly don't know exactly what to recommend as the best process, what the best device is, what should we say should be done everywhere is in that language. And keep in mind that as we were working on this language, the AER, Division 9 Environmental Access Committee, of which I'm chair, ACB, Blind Veterans Association, were working with traffic engineers. And if you want to have a great time, try locking yourself into a room with traffic engineers for 14 hours and negotiate this language. I guarantee you won't come out the same at the other end. But so this is a negotiated compromise. It's a beginning first step. I guarantee you that that language will change if it is in this document. It will change 5 years from now, but it will never come out again. This first step allows for accessible pedestrian signals, allows for those devices that are currently on the market, encourages standardization of pole placement, encourages separation of push buttons onto two poles, encourages the use of tactile arrows saying what street is governed by what push button, encourages the use of braille and raised print to indicate what street is served by what push button, does not say what sound must be used for what street, or cuckoos and chirps and bells and buzzers, or whatever. There are such variation across the country that we could not limit it. However, there is research money, large research money, and Richard and David mentioned some of it coming down the pike for these types of topics, so that within 5 years we should be able to come up with some recommended standards, and I think the next prescription, shall we say, in the MUTCD will be tighter. The effect of this, even the fact that it appeared in the Federal Register, the effect has been immediate. To give you one example, in Michigan, at another school for dog guides, Michigan. Leader dog, that's it. Yeah, I knew. Okay, thank you. They have a large intersection outside the school that they've been having trouble with. People can't get across the intersection immediately across outside the school, and they've been petitioning for years for an accessible signal there. They were shut down because it didn't appear in the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices. Just because it appeared in the Federal Register, they were able to get it approved. In the city of Parma Heights, Ohio, Dorothy Nagel has and an intrepid band of workers has gotten an incredible job done, gotten 12 accessible signals. Is it 12? Six intersections equipped with accessible pedestrians. It was a tremendous job. How? Citizen action, political pressure, got it done. Tremendous job. Things are moving, folks. The world's changing. Congratulations.
And now the bad good boy that everybody loves, our Executive Director, Charlie Crawford, to back cleanup for the next 2 or 3 minutes.
2 or 3 minutes?
That's the best.
Hi. Goodbye. No. Well, thank you, Debbie, for my two or three minutes. I've already used 10 seconds of them.
20.
Thank you, Mr. President. I first of all want to say at the macro level that we truly do owe a debt of gratitude to Lucas Frank from the Seeing Eye and the Seeing Eye itself for having given us the resources that we could then match ourselves to get the pedestrian safety handbook out of the office and into the hands of advocates where it does the real good for people trying to cross streets. So congratulations and thank you. I also want to thank those affiliates of ACB that contributed the matching money necessary to get those pedestrian safety handbooks into the hands of people. And all the names of the people that have contributed will be listed in the handbook because we really do owe a debt of gratitude to those folks. Given the fact that I've only been given 2 or 3 minutes, I will condense my remarks that I wanted to make with respect to how we're really getting it done. Now, I whispered in Lucas's ear, well, not so much of a whisper, you're stealing my thunder when he said Parma Heights. And the reason I said that to him is because the real solution to pedestrian safety is not in the National Office of ACB. It's not in the research that's being done. It's on the mayor's steps. It's in the offices of the city councils. It's in the hearts and minds of the people that make decisions at the local level. Where ACB and the research can be real helpful is in the partnership that we can form with our local communities. And I want to especially acknowledge Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Donna Rose. Are you here? Well, perhaps not. Must be out being a pedestrian. I want to thank Joe Talafaro from Grand Rapids, Michigan, for her work that she's doing to make Grand Rapids an accessible city. And I do want to give my special congratulations to Dorothy and the folks from Parma Heights. It's not just happening in Michigan, guys. It's not just happening in Ohio. It's happening in cities and towns across this country that blind people, because we have become aware that we have the tools, we have the power, we have the vision, and we have the resources to move as local communities in partnership with ACB to make a change in our pedestrian environment. It is happening. It will continue to happen. And I invite all of you to be in touch with the national office so that we can work together in your local community to make that difference. We have had the success. It does work. And let's get to work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes our panel.
And thank you very much, Debbie. You've done good and you're on time. That's great. I'm impressed. Okay, we now move on to our partner in looking at our future together. And our first speaker here will be a long, long time friend of ACB and, like me, an old Ohioan, who said, "Where's Parma Heights?" And I said, "I know where that is. It's just south of Cleveland." I'd like to introduce, yes. No, I'm sorry, we don't. Okay, may I suggest that we bring this up? Perhaps the executive director will be having a report, and I'm sure he will address some more pedestrian safety issues, and perhaps that would be an appropriate time. We have a guest speaker that we need to accommodate, so thank you very much. Okay, it is my pleasure now to introduce to you the president of the American Foundation for the Blind, which is headquartered in New York City, our friend Carl Augusto. Carl?
Thank you, Pat. As many of you do, we, as blind people, try to do as much as we can to educate the public about the capabilities of blind people and really to show members of the public that we're just like anyone else. I started doing that in college when I was speaking periodically to groups of physical therapy and occupational therapy students. And one day, I was speaking to a PT class, and during the question and answer period, a co-ed from the back of the room asked the question, did I date or go to the movies? Now, I was really surprised by that kind of question and somewhat annoyed. So on an impulse, I said, is that a formal invitation? And, of course, some of her classmates giggled a little bit, but I was dead serious. And she paused and finally weakly agreed and said yes. So a couple of days later, I had my big chance to show her that I was just like all the other guys on campus. So I picked her up at the dorm. We walked over to the only movie house in town. Because we were conversing, we didn't even bother noticing what the movie was. It was the only movie house in town anyway. So we were walking down the aisle, and she says, well, you know, what do I do? And I said, well, just tell me what's on the screen that I can't detect. It's an important part of the movie that I can't detect from the dialogue. So she said, fine. So we sat there. The movie opened with two people speaking in German. Now, there were subtitles, so she said, what do I do now? So I said, I guess you're going to have to start reading me some subtitles. And she said, okay. So she snuggled a little bit more closely to me, which was fine and dandy. And then there was the very first pause in the movie. And it was a pretty extended pause. She wasn't saying anything, and I started detecting on the speakers heavy breathing on the screen. So I asked her, what's happening now? She answered, I don't think I want to tell you. To make a long story short, it was an X-rated German movie. Now, she turned out to be a pretty good reader, but she was awful in giving me the description of what was happening on the screen. But I think I did achieve my mission in showing her that I was just like anyone else. The next day, a mutual friend of mine approached me and said, you know, she thought that was a grand setup, that I knew exactly what the movie was. And she accused me of being just as sex-crazed as all the other guys on campus. So I finally arrived. It's always a pleasure attending conventions of the American Council of the Blind and having an opportunity to update you on what's happening at the American Foundation for the Blind. AFB and ACB have enjoyed a rich tradition of cooperation over the years. We salute Paul Edwards and Charlie Crawford for their tremendous leadership. We think that they have strengthened ACB and increased its power and influence in the blindness field. Currently, two of your other leaders are serving on AFB's Board of Trustees, Leroy Saunders and Brian Charlson, and both have been invaluable to me and also to AFB. I'd like to mention two key staff changes at the American Foundation for the Blind. Scott Marshall, who's been Vice President of Governmental Relations for 12 years, has been appointed to a high-level post at the Federal Communications Commission. Yes, Paul said we trained him well. He is a recipient of the Ambassador's Award, of course, from ACB. He's made many contributions to AFB and advancing our collective legislative agenda. I'll miss my frequent contacts with him and the advice he's given to me on management issues, but he plans to remain very actively involved in our movement. And as a matter of fact, he is heading back to FCC today to continue his work in making sure that FCC regulations and practices will promote total accessibility for people with disabilities. I'm very pleased, and many of you know this, that Paul Schrader will be succeeding Scott Marshall after almost 6 years heading up our Chicago office and our technology programs. As you know, Paul headed up ACB's Governmental Relations Department before joining AFB 6 years ago. Last January, we filled another very critical position, the Vice President of National Programs, which includes all of our offices and all of our programs that we administer. And we were very, very pleased when Scott McCall from Atlanta, Georgia, expressed an interest in the job. And I'm even more pleased that Scott has gotten off to a tremendous start as VP at the American Foundation for the Blind. You know Scott is a former executive director of the Center for the Visually Impaired in Atlanta, and he's known to many of you since he has attended these meetings and also Ski for Light from, that many of you have also attended. So now I'm going to turn it over to Scott McCall, who will be giving you an update on AFB. Please welcome Scott McCall.
Thank you, Carl. And from Carl's opening story, you can certainly understand his strong support for descriptive video activities. It's certainly a pleasure for me to be here and to have an opportunity to update you on some of the activities at the American Foundation for the Blind, and also to have been here for the last 3 days and have a chance to renew some friendships and make some new friendships and discuss our common goals. And as I talk about the activities of the past year at AFB, you'll recognize many of the themes because many of our activities reflect the strong partnership that we have had with ACB over the years and that continues to grow and strengthen. As I was putting together a list of activities that I wanted to mention, two words came to mind. The first was traditional, because many of the activities that I'm talking about represent traditional activities that AFB has been involved in for many years and continue to be important at AFB. The second word was new, because some of the activities represent new challenges and new initiatives at AFB that we believe are addressing the most important issues that face those of us who are blind and visually impaired in the 21st century. I know that many of you are familiar with AFB Press, which is one of those traditional activities that has been a major publishing force in our field, publishing primarily materials that are used in our teacher training programs and for training professionals in the field of rehabilitation. I hope that you've heard about a new publication, a book entitled To Love This Life. To Love This Life is a different kind of book for AFB Press. It's a book of quotations by Helen Keller. The book represents many of the more familiar quotations from Helen Keller, but also quotations from some of her private correspondence. We had the opportunity to preview the audio version of the book at our breakfast yesterday, and the book is available. You can order it at booth 59 in the exhibit area. That's the AFB booth. The cost of both the print and audio version is $21.95, and you get a 10% convention discount. One of the things that we're very excited about with the audio version of this book is that it's narrated by Patty Duke. So I hope that you'll all check that out at the AFB booth. We continue to be very involved in the talking book industry this year, recording approximately 500 talking books for the National Library Service, and that continues to be an important activity at the American Foundation for the Blind. Another one of our traditional efforts is in the area of advocacy. For many years, AFB has had a strong legislative advocacy program, working closely with ACB and other organizations and partners to influence and promote legislation to improve lives and opportunities for those of us who are blind and visually impaired. This past year, with your help and the help of many others, our advocacy efforts focused on increasing the funding for the Independent Living Program to serve seniors who are visually impaired. This is known as the Chapter 2 program that I know many of you are familiar with. This is a program that's been in existence for a number of years, but the funding has been flat for a number of years. So we took this on as a challenge to increase that funding. We're pleased that through the cooperative work of a lot of partners this past year, the funding level was increased from approximately $12 million to $15 million, which by federal funding standards is a significant increase. But that's not enough. We all know that. And we have redoubled our efforts this year. And the budget process is still going on, and this is certainly not an announcement by any stretch of the imagination, but we are very encouraged by the activities in the budget committees, and we are anticipating that when the budget is signed, that the funding for this program will increase somewhere from $15 million to around $18 to $20 million. But that's still not going to be enough. We will redouble our efforts next year to continue to advocate for funding to increase availability of independent living services for seniors who are blind and visually impaired. Like you, we are very concerned about employment and employment opportunities. The problem of unemployment is a concern. The problem of underemployment is another concern. We've taken two steps this past year to address that problem. Our publication, Are You Looking for a Few Good Workers?, is a brochure that has been sold and distributed throughout the country, both to rehabilitation personnel and to HR personnel with major corporations. We have just ordered a second printing of that brochure, and we will have more of those to distribute because we believe that this brochure contains information that educates and informs corporate leaders about the value of employing qualified blind and visually impaired persons. And it's also an excellent tool for rehabilitation counselors and job placement staff. We have also been involved with Mississippi State University Research and Training Center over the past several years in a major training initiative to provide training to give rehabilitation personnel more skills and more information to help them succeed in the job placement arena. An area of mutual concern is certainly in education. We, for many years, like you, have been concerned that students who are blind and visually impaired do not receive their textbooks or materials on day one of the school year. This is a major barrier to those students in their success in school. Several years ago, with a number of partners, we formed the Solutions Forum, and the primary objective of that group is to work out the details between the publishers, the education directors in the various states, to cut through all of the issues to make sure that when the school bell rings on day one, that blind and visually impaired children have their textbooks and their materials. That's another effort that is underway. Significant progress has been made. I didn't realize until I started talking with our staff what a complicated issue this is. But in recent years, we've been able to demonstrate, I think, to the publishers that this is a very feasible objective, and I believe that soon we will have some very positive announcements to make related to education and getting textbooks in the hands of children. The area of technology is one that is of great concern to us, and I hope that many of you are familiar with our new publication, Access World. Access World is a publication that was previewed in October and started its official publication in January. When we started the magazine, we thought that by the end of our first year, we might have 1,000 subscribers. That was Paul Schrader's estimate. And within 6 months, we have achieved over 1,100 subscribers to Access World. And I hope that as a result of you learning about Access World at this meeting, that we will continue to increase that subscribership. We think this is an excellent publication addressing issues both of assistive technology and mainstream technology. We've had some focus groups to identify issues that are important to consumers and to readers, and we hope that you will continue to communicate with us to let us know what you would like to see addressed through Access World. In the area of technology, we're also concerned about accessibility, and we have continued through Paul Schrader's efforts to be very active in Washington, making comments regarding federal legislation, particularly Section 255 of the Telecommunications Act, with the goal of making sure that products, websites, all aspects of technology are accessible to those of us who are blind and visually impaired. Literacy has been a major focus at AFB for at least 10 or 11 years. It started with our work, I think, in Braille literacy. That work has continued and continues to be a cornerstone of our interest in literacy, but we have now broadened our view of literacy to include access to information not only in Braille, but through large print, screen magnification, and technology. To continue our literacy program and, in fact, to broaden our efforts in literacy, we have recently opened the National Literacy Center in Atlanta. We have moved into expanded space to house our research library, provide training facilities, and over the next 12 to 18 months, you will hear a lot about our national efforts in literacy. To summarize the goals of the Literacy Center, we are very concerned about the shortage of qualified instructors to teach Braille and other literacy skills in our schools and rehabilitation centers. And one of the primary objectives of the National Literacy Center will be to train and produce more qualified instructors to deliver that service. We've talked a lot about technology, and at the American Foundation for the Blind, we have been very concerned about our own website. We've had a website at afb.org for a number of years. Hope many of you have visited it, and you know that on the website is a great deal of information. However, it hasn't always been easy to locate some of the information on the website. Over the past several months, we have had a team of our employees working with a group of consultants to totally redesign our website. Our first goal is that it be completely accessible. We also want it to be comprehensive and, as people say, interesting, because when someone visits our website to get information, we want the site to be interesting enough for them to stay there and look at other information on the website and linked to other resources that would be of interest. We hope that you will continue to visit us and to look in at afb.org and give us feedback on the website as it begins to emerge. Yesterday, Krista Earle presented a brief overview of what the website homepage will look like, and I would think that within the next, I'm hesitant to use dates, but I would think within the next 2 to 3 months that you will see very significant changes at afb.org. Those are highlights of the activities that we've been engaged in. As I said at the beginning, many of these themes will be familiar to you because they are activities that we are partners in and that we cooperate together to make sure that we move these initiatives forward. Madam Chair, if there's time for a couple of questions, we'll be happy to answer those. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Are there questions for our team from the American Foundation for the Blind? Must have been a really, really complete report. Sounded like it to me. I want to thank Scott and Carl Augusto for that glimpse of our future as partners on behalf of blind and visually impaired Americans. AFB is always a leader. The leader. All right, we have a couple of minutes, and the chairman of our Constitution and Bylaws Committees has the duty of reading to you four pages, which is just very quick, four proposed amendments that we will then be voting on tomorrow. We're just going to hear them read today. Kathy Wheeler?
Okay. Page 7, amend Article 4, Officers, Section A. No, that's not right. Okay, anyway, we're going to put in a Section G and reletter the following sections appropriately. The proposed wording, Section G, the President may call a special meeting of the Board of Directors at any time and shall call a special meeting of the Board of Directors at the request of at least 5 members of the Board. Written notice of the meeting shall be forwarded to each member of the board postmarked at least 14 days prior to the meeting date. The time, the location, and the specific purpose of the meeting shall be included in the notice. Now remember, as in the amendment we took care of today, we have at least 5 members. You may amend this amount of members down. You cannot amend it upward. Second Amendment, Braille page 12. Amend Article 5, Powers and Duties of the Convention, Officers, the Board of Directors, and Committees, by adding a new section to the end of the article. Proposed wording. The duty of the nominating committee shall be to select candidates, all of whom, if elected, are eligible to serve in the positions for which the committee has nominated them. And this, if adopted, will take effect after this convention ends. Braille page 13. Amend Article 6 meetings by lettering the one paragraph that's in that Article A and adding a Section B. B, a special meeting of the organization shall be called if 75% of the affiliates so request in writing, sent by certified mail to the national office. Written notice of the meeting shall be forwarded to each affiliate president, postmarked at least 60 days prior to the meeting date. The notice shall also be posted in the Braille Forum, on the ACB website, and in all other media regularly employed to communicate with the membership. The time, the location, and the specific purpose of the meeting shall be included in the notice. We thought that a proper reason for a special meeting of the whole convention would be if the hotel that all of the board was staying in for a meeting blew up. That's about all. Braille page 31. Amend bylaw 7. Now this has to do with the Board of Publications, not the Board of Directors. Amend bylaw 7 by inserting a period after the word terms in the phrase which reads, provided, however, that no board member shall serve more than 3 consecutive terms, and striking out the rest of the sentence. The phrase to be stricken is, and no more than 1 board member shall be appointed or elected to the Board of Publications from any one state. So we're taking out the residency requirement for the Board of Publications. The bylaw would then read, the board shall be selected and constituted in the following manner. Every odd-numbered year, the president at the close of the annual convention shall appoint a chairperson and 1 additional member of the board. And every even year, and every even year, the annual convention shall elect by a majority vote in accordance with the voting procedures contained in the Constitution or in bylaws the three remaining members of the board, provided, however, that no board member shall serve more than three consecutive terms. That ends my report, Madam Chairman.
And thank you, Madam Chairman. Okay, we will vote on these proposals tomorrow. Eugene and Susan Willis, get ready for door prizes. And members, remember that if you have caucus announcements, they must go to the convention office and the press room, and the deadline is 2 p.m. today if you expect it to be in the newspaper, so that everybody will know about your intentions. Remember, the exhibits close at 1 p.m. today, just about 1 hour from now, so you've just got a very short time. Okay? And the resolutions, as you'll recall, are due no later than 10 p.m. tonight in room 1700. And, Mr. President, you have a quick announcement?
It's just to remind everyone who is a committee chair that there is a committee chair's breakfast, as has become traditional here at ACB, but reminding committee chairs that they should be in room 346 at 7 a.m. on Friday morning.
Thank you, Mr. President. And now, Susan and Eugene.
Well, this is Eugene first, and we're going to give away a sweatshirt from Kansas Association of Blind and Visually Impaired, and the name is
Bill Powers, Baltimore, Maryland.
Bill Powers, Baltimore, Maryland. Is he here? No. Next, please.
Modesto Favla, Chicago, Illinois.
Modesto Favla, Chicago, Illinois. Are you here? Please draw another name.
Carl McCoy, Tallahassee, Florida.
Carl, are you here? Carl McCoy, Tallahassee, Florida. Draw another name.
Michael Collins, Rapid City, South Dakota.
And the first name is?
Michael Collins.
Michael Collins, Rapid City. Are you here? Draw another name.
Faith Jackson, Richmond, Virginia.
Faith Jackson from Richmond, Virginia. Are you here? Draw another name.
Edna Freeman, St. Charles, Missouri.
Hey. Okay, Edna's here. Okay. And the door prize is the T-shirt from Kansas Association. Oh, a sweatshirt from Kansas Association. Ah, you'll look lovely, Edna. All righty. Another door prize. What is it, please?
Okay, we're going to give some money away now. So, yeah, okay. I knew y'all held on for something.
How much money?
First one is in memory of Mr. John Brockington, past president of the Georgia Council of the Blind.
Madam Chair, before you go too farther, Missouri is hollering that Edna was not here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so we still have to give away the T-shirt.
The sweatshirt.
All right, go ahead and draw another name.
Another name, Edward Guerra, Austin, Texas.
Edward Guerra?
Guerra.
From Texas. Are you in the room? Draw another name.
James Edwards, Portsmouth, Virginia.
There. James Edwards, are you here? James Edwards, are you here? Okay. Okay, now let's give away some money.
We got the money from Georgia, in memory of John Brockington, $25.
Mary Davis, Doylestown, Pennsylvania.
Mary Davis, Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Are you here? No. Draw another name.
Donald Lutz, Ravenna, Ohio.
Donald Lutz, Ravenna, Ohio. He is here? Okay. $25. In memory of John Brockman, former president of Georgia Council of the Blind. Next one.
The Ohio Council of the Blind has given away $20.
Is this the Ohio Council?
This next one, yeah. The 25 went to somebody else, so we got 20 now from Ohio.
Mike Mandel, New York, New York.
Well, Mike Mandel was here earlier providing music. Is he still here? Mike Mandel? Draw another name.
Deborah Jenkins, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Deborah Jenkins from Fairbanks, Alaska. Are you here?
No, I don't think she is.
Draw another name.
Otis Stevens, Knoxville, Tennessee.
Otis Stevens, Knoxville, Tennessee. Are you here? He's gone home. Sorry. All right, draw another name.
Greg Brayton, Coldwater, Michigan.
Greg from Coldwater?
Greg Brayton.
Brayton?
Brayton, yes.
Coldwater, Michigan. Are you here? Draw another name. How much money is this one for?
Lorraine Phoenix, New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Lorraine Phoenix, New
Lorraine Phoenix.
New Bedford, Massachusetts. Are you here? Draw another name.
Charlene Pickett, Muskogee, Oklahoma.
Charlene Pickett from Muskogee, Oklahoma. Charlene?
Charlene Pickett.
She's probably doing helping tear down the exhibit from Envision. Okay, next one. Charlene, did I hear you? Charlene?
Okay. Have somebody come and get it.
Charlene, was that you? Yep, okay. Sounded like an Oklahoma accent to me. All right, do you have one? Another quick one?
Yeah.
Okay.
This one is for $50.
All right.
And it's from Alaska, so they have good money too.
$50, is this from Alaska Independent Blind? Okay. $50 goes to
Alice Lee, Swartzville, Pennsylvania.
Alice Lee from Pennsylvania, are you here? She's not here. Draw another name for $50.
Earlene Brockington, Fitzgerald, Georgia.
Earlene Brockington, Fitzgerald, Georgia, are you here? Draw another name, $50.
Jessica Trask, Salt Lake City, Utah.
Jessica, are you here? She is not here. Let's try to give that $50 away one more time.
John Woodward, Anchorage, Alaska.
John is here? They reclaimed
their
own.
I think we've got a winner on that one.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, American Council of the Blind is in recess until 8:30 tomorrow morning. Thank you.